One, two, three, four.
Hello, and welcome to episode 9 of the Behind the Curtain Ministry Podcast. As always, just want to remind you to check out at acrossroads.net. That's my personal blog. And there you will find bonus material for every episode of the podcast. And particularly today's, there'll be some great bonus links that you'll want to check out. Today we're going to be interviewing Luke Gilkerson. Luke is the Educational Resource Manager at Covenant Eyes. If you're not familiar with Covenant Eyes, they are very large sexual purity software company. They're a Christian company, and they provide online filters as well as online accountability software and a bunch of really great free resources, which you can check out at acrossroads.net. Also, if while listening today, if you decide Covenant Eyes is a software you want to add yourself onto your mobile devices, your computers, laptops, if you use the promo code Crossroads, that's Crossroads with an S at the end, you will get your first 2 months free. I am an affiliate for Covenant Eyes. I use them myself, and I really love their product. I also am on their official blogging team and write blogs for them periodically and have a lot of respect for their company. Looking forward to this conversation with Luke today. We will be talking about specifically why do pastors look at pornography and why do pastors have affairs. Obviously, it's something that will apply to everyone, but particularly want to mention the unique role of pastors, both for churchgoers to be able to support their pastors better and for pastors and those considering ministry leadership to really be intentional about this area of their life. Luke also has a personal blog, which we'll link to on my site, intoxicatedonlife.com, and he is the author of The Talk, 7 Lessons to Introduce Your Child to Biblical Sexuality. He's also the author of Coming Clean, Overcoming Lust Through Biblical Accountability, and Luke runs the Covenant Eyes blog and is a frequent author there as well. So with that, let's bring Luke in to the podcast. Well, Luke, thanks so much for joining us on the podcast. I really appreciate having you on.
Noah, it is great being on the podcast. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, why don't you start by telling us a little bit about what Covenant Eyes offers? I'm assuming some listeners have not heard of Covenant Eyes before. Can you just kind of start with a little bit about what you guys do and what you provide?
Sure, no problem. You know, we've been around for over 15 years now, and the company really is founded on the idea that we do better when we take our habits, especially our internet habits, out of the darkness and into the light. Mm-hmm. That when we have accountability for what we look at on the internet, it not only helps us to think twice about the websites we go to, but it also helps to build then good habits that aren't just based on, you know, blocking and filtering. We have a filter that is available for anyone who wants to use our internet filter to block websites, but what we are best known for is our accountability program, which will compile all a list of all the websites that you go to, rate each one of those websites according to any sort of objectionable content, sexual content that's on those sites, and then compile all that information into a very easy-to-read report that someone else can view and have sent to their inbox. So that might be a man who wants to say he wants to stop looking at pornography or something like that, or a woman who wants to stop looking at pornography will have a friend or a group of friends that receive an emailed report every week where they can look over the details of that report. Even just knowing that that report is going to be sent helps mm-hmm. the person to think twice about where they go. In addition, a person will also start to develop a sense of safety around confessing these problems. So if you've got a good friend who's receiving this report or a group of friends who receive this report, they can develop a kind of accountability relationship and a friendship that's based on transparency and honesty so that if something does happen, let's say that you binge on porn one night or something happens like that, a person who received that information, there's not even room for pretense. There's not even room to dodge the question. You have already put it out there before the sin even took place, that you're allowing this person or this group of people to have access to that part of your life. So now when you get together face to face with that person and you talk about it, it's not this, sort of dragging out the facts of what happened. You know, they already know what happened. Mm-hmm. Now we're getting just straight to the why. Well, why did it happen? Let's talk about your heart. Let's talk about what's going mm-hmm. on in your life. Let's mm-hmm. talk about what's there. You've already sort of, it's kind of like a way to pay it forward in your confession that you've yeah. already made you've already taken the steps in your life to do this. Of course, the software has great applicability to families, parents who can monitor what their kids are doing on the internet, kids who are very young who are getting online, even teenagers. And of course, while filtering is very appropriate for little kids, as kids get older, the accountability features then more or less kind of grow along with your kids. Mm-hmm. Because ultimately, you're not raising children, you're raising future adults.
Right.
And these are people who they have to learn that they're going to live in a world without filters, without fences. And so we have to prepare our children for that. So a lot of parents use accountability as sort of that way to give their children, and especially their teenagers, freedom on the internet with the knowledge that they'll be held accountable to those freedoms. They're giving them choices, the ability to make those choices, but they're going to be held accountable to those choices. Which is, ultimately, hopefully what our kids as they grow up and as they become adults and they leave the home and they get jobs and they go into the workforce and they get married and they have their own children. That's the kind of lifestyles we want them to live, that they know they're free to make these choices, but they should be held accountable to those choices, because those choices don't just impact them. They impact their families, their communities, their churches, everybody.
Yeah. And one thing I love, and we'll talk a little bit more about this at the end, about Covenant Eyes, is that you guys are Christian company, and with mm-hmm. that comes, you guys do an excellent job of providing a whole bunch of free resources, which I've used other filter companies in the past, and a lot of times, filter is just a filter. It's just like training. I think of it like a lot of sexual purity approaches are like training yourself like you would train a dog, and it's just a matter of behavior. Okay, slap myself if I do that sort of thing, whereas you guys are providing and all this for free. I'll just mention that to listeners. You don't have to be a Covenant member to access your blog and your ebooks and those sorts of things. So we'll hit on those links specifically at the end, but I just want to say I appreciate that approach. It's a very holistic approach. It's almost like you guys are a discipleship avenue that's all wound up in one into a sexual purity sort of avenue. And so that's awesome. And I bring that up because what I want to talk about initially is pastors and pornography. And so, you guys have a unique, unique ministry, really, because a lot of your ministry is done within the church. You know, a lot of people that use your products are Christians. On your blog, you'll have articles for pastors, by pastors, those sorts of things. And so, this podcast is called Behind the Curtain, the Behind the Curtain Ministry Podcast. And just kind of unveiling the curtain of ministry so that church goers can see kind of what it's like for their pastors to be in leadership, and as well as for pastors to get them help. Obviously, porn, sexual sin, affairs, those sorts of things, they are one of the biggest things that happens, behind the curtain. And so I just kind of want to lay the table with that as we get started. But I'm wondering, why do you think pastors are looking at pornography, first of all?
Well, a risk stating the obvious here, and the first primary reason why pastors look at pornography is the same reason why everybody looks at pornography,
right.
And that is because it's really enjoyable to look at. It slakes lust. It is something that is exciting, exhilarating for people to watch. People enjoy porn because it is not just titillating sexually, but because it is an attempt to meet all kinds of, a lot of things, like a lot of addictions can be,
mm-hmm.
an attempt to deal with unmet concerns, desires that are kind of brooding beneath the surface. even whether it's soothing certain pains in our life, escape, a desire for intimacy, desire for romance, even out of anger or out of whatever. There's all kinds of hidden desires that go with looking at porn, as well as the more obvious ones, just more on the surface kind of lust desires. And pastors are people too. Pastors look at this material for the same reason everybody looks at this material. That's the base. That's the basic answer. But I think if you were going to ask, what is the, is there something peculiar to a pastor's life that makes them more susceptible to temptations to watch pornography? Mm-hmm. Well, then that's a whole other conversation. Because I do think there are things that are peculiar to a pastor's life that make them perhaps more of a sitting duck for this sure. type of temptation. There was a study that was done, a survey that was done a few years ago. I found 55% of pastors will say that pastoral ministry makes them feel lonely. There was another study that was done by a man named Dr. Vincent Yoder, and I spoke with Dr. Yoder about a year ago and interviewed him about his study and tried to understand what his study was all about. He basically was getting surveys from websites that were people were frequenting to look at pornography, and was I won't get into the details of how he gathered all the information, but as he gathered all the information from all these pornography users, he was also sampling, trying to get an understanding of what's their vocation, what do they do in life, he was also measuring. He was doing psychological studies to measure how lonely they were. There's sort of a loneliness quotient. And what he found was, this is really kind of interesting, that clergy, pastors, priests, people who would identify as clergy, who are looking at porn, rate the absolute highest of any vocation when it comes to loneliness.
Wow.
So, now, of course, are all pastors desperately lonely? No. Are all pastors isolated? No. That's not the point. The point is that you can have, it's easy to have within ministry, this feeling that you are an island, that you are alone in your pastoral task, and that maybe others don't understand exactly what you're experiencing in the stresses that you're experiencing or whatever,
right.
and you feel
right.
isolated and cut off and lonely.
Yeah.
And then you have this this problem that broods. First of all, so that's just take those two facts. Right, those two facts straight as we have them right now. One is that pastors are people too, and they like looking at porn for the same reasons everybody does. And second is that pastors can be a very lonely crowd, a very lonely breed of people. Okay,
right.
Just those two facts alone is a recipe for a problem. Just even if we decide nothing else, that's a recipe for a problem, because people who are isolated and cut off are going to be more susceptible to these kind of temptations. There's actually there's kind of a couple ends to this problem. The first problem is that if accountability, as I was saying before, if accountability is part of the solution,
right,
having someone around you to help you is part of the solution, then being cut off from accountability is part of the problem. We need to have that in our life in order to break free from these things. We need to have other people. God has given us other human beings in the church as a means of grace to bring about transformation and sanctification in our lives. And so we need that. If we are cut off from that, there's going to be a problem.
Yeah.
So that's the first end of this, of the loneliness problem. The second is that loneliness, even if it's not experienced in terms of accountability, right? If we're cut off from loving contact with other people, if we feel isolated, even if we're in a crowd, feeling alone in a crowd, probably people have experienced that before, feeling alone in a crowd, even if we're surrounded by people all the time, we can still feel very alone. This is actually one of the things that leads to all kinds of problems and all kinds of addictions in our life.
Sure.
Let me tell a story, because I think the story will be very fitting in this.
Yeah, sure.
And it'll seem like a kind of a weird story to start with. Back in the 60s and 70s, people were studying the nature of addictions, and they often used lab rats. And of course, they take these rats, they put them in little metal cages or in a Skinner box or something like that, and they would, you know, give them food pellets or water laced with heroin, or they'd give them a, you know, they'd get a lever and they'd get an injection of morphine or something like that. Well, of course, as would be predicted, all these rats would get addicted to the drug, and many of them end up overdosing and dying from it. They literally pleasure themselves to death, these rats in these little cages. Well, back in the early 70s, mid-70s, some psychologists at Simon Fraser University were looking at these experiments and saying, there's something wrong here. Rats are social creatures, and yet here we are taking them out of their very natural environment, and we're throwing them into isolation and then giving them as much drugs as they want. And, you know, kind of saying, well, if I was thrown in solitary confinement for the rest of my life, and then just given an endless supply of drugs, how easy would it be for me to get a
drug? Right.
So they said, let's change the experiment. So what they did is they built what they called Rat Park, which was a huge, it was 200 times bigger than any laboratory cage. It was a huge plywood-walled playground for rats. And there was all kinds of, there was tons of rats in there, and they could, you know, eat together and mate and sleep together and be together and play together. And there was all kinds of, you know, fresh cedar shavings everywhere and little wheels they can spin on. And, you know, it was like rat heaven.
Right.
So they threw the rats in this, and then they gave them a choice. You can either have this morphine-laced water, or you can have this regular tap water over here. And what's interesting is that the rats in Rat Park were not getting addicted to the morphine water. They would sample it. They would try it. They might go back to it from time to time, but they actually preferred the tap water over the morphine water. And then they ramped up the experiment. They said, okay, let's make this harder for them. So first they isolated the rats. They put them in cages, isolated them, got them thoroughly addicted to morphine just so they could be knowing that they're experiencing withdrawal symptoms. Then they took them out of the cages and put them back in Rat Park. They still didn't stay addicted to the morphine water. And what this has led to is sort of a this understanding that addictions are not just, I mean, while there is a neurological component to addictions, obviously there is, right? Because you can, if you, you know, force feed someone a drug, they will experience withdrawal. So there is a neurological side to addictions.
Sure.
That's a very real thing. But what is leading to these continuing lifestyles of addiction is the isolation. When people are cut off, in fact, there's even one probably really good social experiment for this. It wasn't intended this way, but you might think of something like the Vietnam War. It was about 15-20% of the soldiers who went away to the Vietnam War got addicted to some kind of drug that they were using while they were there. When they came home, though, 95% of all those who got addicted were able to break free from their addictions without any professional help at all. And what changed? Well, what changed was they left their stable home environment. They went away to some other world that was, you know, a living hell.
Yeah.
Got addicted to something and came back to that same stable environment. Now, what typically happens, unfortunately, for a lot of addicts, whether it's porn or alcohol or anything, is your addiction actually ends up messing up your world. You know, you ruin some of your treasured family relationships, family, your kids, your wife, your spouse, anything, right? So your addictions can impact other people. In this case, you had people who left their world, got addicted somewhere else in some other place in the world, and then came back. Not only did they not have access to the same kind of drugs that they had over there, but they also were, again, now surrounded by the family that they left before. So what we're noticing about the nature of addictions to anything, whether it be porn or alcohol or drugs or whatever, is that often our addictions are responses to isolation. We want connection. We want vibrant connection with other people. In fact, God says we're built for connection, right? We're built for connection to Him. We're built for connection to community, for family. This is what we were designed for. And in our very, you know, quite frankly, isolated world, where even though we might have friends, those friends can tend to be kind of distant. We might be connecting primarily through social media and not face-to-face.
We might be
in in this environment that we're really, quite frankly, not built for. And the human mind just isn't built for that kind of isolation, isn't built for that kind of a world. And this is what happens. We end up so if I could kind of draw a picture of it, it would be one is our desire for relationship at the core, the center of who we are. This is part of what it means to be made in the image of God.
Mm-hmm.
On the outside of that, you've got the next concentric circle, if you will, is sin, that we're fallen creatures, and therefore that taints and that twists that original desire for human connection and relationship. Then you take that sin and you put that sinful person with that desire for relationship, the next concentric circle would be in an environment where they're isolated, where they feel lonely, where they feel cut off, where they feel neglected, where they feel like they're deprived of something. And then the reaction to that is going to be trying to seek for the best buzz they can get in the midst of that isolation. They desire connection, they desire whatever. And pornography is a perfect example of this, because not only is it something that it gives you a high, but it's also something that feeds this. It's a sort of, as Dr. Harry Schomburg might call it, false intimacy. It is a parody of intimacy. I want this connection, and it's a sort of an example of a type of false intimacy that you're going to experience. And so I think this is – and so having said all of that, let's go back to the pastors.
Right.
The pastors now who feel that they're kind of cut off, feel kind of lonely, and now they're in this situation where – they have this access to pornography. People generally assume that everything is okay with them because they're pastoral people. They're in, you know, they're in professional Christian ministry, so therefore they must be people of integrity. There's not necessarily, that people are necessarily going to be checking up on them, or if they are being checked up on, it might not be a very robust sort of accountability that they're experiencing. Mm-hmm. They're isolated, they're cut off, and now they're getting addicted to this stuff, and they're holding on to other secret sexual sins. I would say, now, having said all of that, then you add on to the pastoral situation even more factors that I think could be a problem. One is the temptations of what does it feel like to live on a pedestal all the time?
Right.
That's a huge one. If people are often looking up to you, this is either going to lead to an enormous amount of pride, which can it sets you up for all kinds of sins. Not just sexual sins, but all kinds of sins. One, it could produce enormous amount of pride, or two, it can lead to an enormous kind of hypocrisy, a secret life, a double life, where you have to try to keep it squeaky clean on this side of your life, but over here you want to do what you want to do, and it can lead to those kind of secret life. There's also things problems where. Pastors are often, especially in small churches, pastors are often running Lone Ranger type ministries,
mm-hmm.
where they don't have a team of other pastors around them. They're the pastor, and the persons who are responsible for their continued spiritual growth, their continued integrity, their own discipleship, their own growth into the Christian life, are people who. May or may not be equipped to, or even for that matter, feel free to have those kind of conversations with the pastor. There's not necessarily this organic relationship between the pastor and, say, a board that hired him, or a group of elders, or a group of deacons, or whatever the governmental structure of the church is. They don't necessarily. There's still that sense that the pastor's this guy over here, and we're over on the other side. There's a sense that he's not one of us. He's something different. Then, of course, pastors are often open to public criticism, maybe more so than other people.
Sure.
Where people don't like what's going on in the church, pastors are often the brunt of that, and so that can continue to feed the isolation. There's often heavy expectations placed on pastors that only further isolate them from their families.
Right.
So you have a sense of you have to be in the office at these times. You have to be visiting people. You have to be going to the hospitals. You have to be calling people and doing this and the other thing. And there's a sense of high expectations that might be placed on a pastor. And those high expectations, even if they are good expectations, can often lead to pastors being cut off from the people that love them the most. And then I think on top of all of this is a real systemic problem in churches overall, which is we don't know what to do about pastoral moral failings.
Mm-hmm.
We just don't know what to do about it. Mm-hmm. We're okay if it's some socially acceptable vice.
Sure.
You know, if it's something that, you know, he watches too much TV or he doesn't read his Bible enough or something like that, we don't care about that. But when it comes to things that are not socially acceptable vices or things that really do bring slander to the ministry, like affairs, like pornography, drug use is, of course, in there, alcoholism. I speak to pastors who deal with that, too. When you have those kind of problems, churches simply don't know what to do about it. And unfortunately, what we've done in a lot of cases is churches react rather than respond.
Mm-hmm.
A principled idea in place of what we need to do to deal with this, they often simply react and cut the person off. They just say, "Okay, you're let go from the ministry."
Right.
And pastors, I think they know that. And so this only feeds the desire to want to keep things a secret.
Yeah.
Because if they can deal with it on their own without asking for help, all the better. Because then no one has to know. The church doesn't suffer reproach. He doesn't suffer reproach. The leadership of the church doesn't suffer reproach from the outside. And so we're okay. If I can just deal with it on my own, then everything will be fine.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, when that often doesn't work, and the addiction only gets worse, and the problem only gets worse, what do we do?
Right.
How do we deal with those situations? And that's the question before churches. And, that's a huge question. And, of course, we can get into that if you want. But that's a big, big problem that churches have. And it doesn't just touch the pornography issue. Churches need to be equipped, leadership of churches need to be equipped with how do we handle habitual or grossly immoral or what have you sins when they're committed by church leadership, whether it's the pastor, whether it's people who are in lay leadership, whatever it is, how do we deal with it? What do we do about it? And they need to have some sort of a sense of a process in mind of this is what has to happen in order for this to work. How do we create a safe environment where our leaders feel free to talk about the things they're dealing with? How do we do that? And then when something does come to the surface, when the church leadership realizes, hey, this person really is struggling with something.
Right.
How do we deal with that now? We need to have an idea in mind of what we're going to do when that happens. And there need to be people in the church who can own that process and say, okay, this has happened. We're gonna follow these. You know, it doesn't have to be a step by step approach. It's not a one size fits all approach for every human being or every situation, but it should be some sense that we have an idea in mind about what to do when these things happen.
Mm.
We have a general outline. We have a general path we need to follow. It's not a predictable path. It's not something where you can just kind of. It's not an equation where if you do this, then your problem's solved. It's not. Solving the problem. I think that's another part of the problem with churches is that often when we'll get calls from churches and they will say, our pastor just was caught with pornography. We're really upset about this. We don't know what to do. We don't know if we should let him go. We don't know where he needs to go now. We don't know what's going to happen.
Yeah.
And they'll ask us, well, we'd like to do something about this. We're going to get covenantized, da-da-da. We're going to monitor his computer. So how long will this take? And they'll say things like, well, how long will this process take? Like, when will he be over? When can he be back in good working order again?
Sure,
and
sure.
You know, we just have – I think not only is that question really difficult to answer or impossible to answer, but it's also not the right question because the pastor is a human being who is part of your local body of believers that needs care just like anybody needs care. And we don't want to have just sort of this productivity mindset when it comes to people, when it comes to other human beings made in the image of God, that we need to see them as, all right, they confessed on Friday, they got some accountability on Sunday, and I want them to be all square to go for the next sermon on the next Sunday. You know, we can't have this sense that we're going to try to rush people through sanctification because we know that's not how it works anyway.
Right.
We have to have a better mentality about this. And so, anyway, that's all.
That's excellent. That's super helpful.
I gave you a lot there. I think I'll stop and breathe now.
Good. Yeah, I think that a church leadership board or a pastor or, a church could listen to what you just said and take bullet point notes. And there is, I mean, I just agree 100% with what you just said. As a pastor myself, you know, I can speak into this a little bit, and I think some in the church would hear, and they would be surprised at what you just said about, let's take like the Vietnam War metaphor, where I think, where for me as a pastor, you know, I was a youth pastor for about a year and a half, and that was, it was pretty, I didn't deal with any of these sort of loneliness issues and such. I didn't have the spotlight directly on me. And then I planted a church, and I've been doing that now for about 10 years. And in sort of a senior role. I was sort of the official senior pastor for about 7 years. And then one thing we did 3 years ago, what I did is I got rid of that title, and we brought in another pastor, and we both like co-lead now. We share authority. And right. That has helped me a lot because, so it's Kurt Wright, and he and I, we work together every day. We share authority. We have different, I do most of the teaching. He does most of the shepherding, but, I'm not his boss. He's not my boss. And so we're able to talk about things like sexual temptation, those sorts of things. Yeah. I think that, and that's something that was missing, for like 7 years, you know, when I was in the senior role. One thing I think church folks get confused by is, they kind of think, well, everything you just said, and they'll say, well, why would that be? I mean, we're nice, aren't we? Like, why wouldn't my pastor want to confide in me? Or why wouldn't my pastor want to, sure, like, be best friends with me? And I think it's hard for non-pastors to understand those, because it almost seems hypocritical as a pastor in a way, certainly contradictory when you're the teacher and you're saying to your church, like, hey, you need to be in community. You need to have accountability in your life. And then, I saw this stat on your guys' website that 75% of pastors did not make themselves accountable to anyone for their internet use. So it's like three out of four pastors are preaching that message theoretically, but they're not able, they're not doing it themselves, or they're not able to do it themselves. And I think that's a real problem. And I think it's something that churches need to hear and figure out how to better support their pastors. And pastors need to hear. Pastors, like myself, need to not make excuses. You might be in a very, could be even an oppressive environment in your ministry, but you still have to make a way. While it's going to be difficult, you may not be able to find it in your church members. You may not be able to find it in your denomination because there's pressure there. You have to produce a certain amount of numbers. You don't want to get fired. You've got to find it somewhere. Maybe that's outside of your church. Maybe that's some friends of yours from college before you were a pastor. That's really helpful because those people never knew you as a pastor. They just knew you for the dumb stuff you did in the dorms, yeah, or whatever. those are people that can hold you accountable just as a friend and as a Christian. So those are some things that have been really helpful to me. But I totally feel your stat of the 55% feeling lonely. And I guess I just want to reiterate some of these things so churchgoers, they don't dismiss what you said by saying, oh, that couldn't be true of our church. and it's not their fault. It's not like they're mean people or their pastor doesn't like them. We do like you. Like, we as pastors do like our church folks. There's just a very weird dynamic, and I don't need to repeat it because you said it so well. There's all these reasons why, really, we're not treated as humans is really what it comes down to. But at the end of the day, we are human. Like, we're human, and so we're going to struggle. We have these needs, and often our job itself takes us away from having those needs met. And so that's exactly why I want to talk about this. I think it is just so important, and it's the reason why we see the stats we see, or it's the reasons why we see headlines of this pastor, you know, they found all this pornography on his computer or whatever. And I guess I'll use that, and this might, obviously a lot of this will overlap, but for those that have been Christians for any length of time, it always seems like in the Christian news or sometimes the national news, a high-profile Christian leader, Christian pastor will have an affair. And, yep. You know, there's been this year some notable ones, you know, and it typically catches us very off guard. You know, we're thinking, man, but I love the book they wrote. I love their preaching. I love their ministry. And then we are just totally flabbergasted that this could happen. And I wonder if, Luke, you could just talk about that a little bit as well. Obviously, pornography and affairs have a lot of overlap, but they're also different. Some people really aren't susceptible to porn, but they are to an affair for one reason or another, and certainly vice versa. So how can, I guess I'll start with why do you think pastors have affairs, and then how can churches support their pastors in ways that can kind of prevent that from happening?
Well, think of just about everything I said about porn, and you can apply a lot of that to affairs when it comes to pastors. They have affairs because of the same reason a lot of people have affairs.
Mm-hmm.
And because they're humans too. Also, affairs are, at least tend to be, secretive matters, like pornography is, and of course happens a lot in isolation. So all those things I said before apply to affairs, or a lot of them anyway do. That said, in some way, the affair also, while it's of course far more risky and has a lot more potentially bad consequences to it, it also is a real seen as a real solution, at least to the heart, to the lonely heart. Seems like a solution to loneliness, because here's this person who accepts me for who I am. There's no pressure. Here I am doing this sinful thing with them, and they still accept me. So I don't feel like I don't feel the pressure that I feel other places. This is
sure.
It's in some ways intoxicating and liberating to be around someone who just lets me be, a rotten sinner, and I can sin with them.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
If you want to be really honest about it, it in some ways feels exhilarating to have mm-hmm. that kind of to be around that kind of a person. Of course, that's the sinful heart speaking, that sinful desire speaking, but they're speaking loud and clear.
Right.
All that said, what do I say to the person who is now disenchanted with the pastor, that specific church, that pastor's books, whatever, or just the church broadly, the church universally? A couple of things I would say to that is reread your Bible again and see how many times God spoke true messages through people who later were convicted of grave sexual sins.
Sure.
How many psalms did David write before he sinned with Bathsheba?
Right.
Are you going to chuck those psalms because you don't? Well, it's different, Luke, because he was inspired by God. Well, I get that. I understand that. But God is in the habit of using, as Paul would say, jars of clay to hold the glorious gospel, right?
Yeah.
We are cracked, broken, dry pots. And the more cracked and the more full of holes we are, the brighter that object inside us can shine. So if we are these broken, terrible vessels, and inside us is the glorious gospel of Jesus Christ, that will shine all the greater through broken people. Broken vessels. So if you've got a guy like David, David's a great example of this. You got a guy like David who he dipped into secret sin for a while, and his secret sin led to not just adultery and a child out of wedlock, but the death of one of his best soldiers that he essentially left for dead on the battlefield. That's a serious problem. That is a grave offense. And yet David responded the right way to it. And if we can look at someone like, if we can say, yeah, I ultimately the kind of guy I want to lead my church is someone who, of course we don't want scandals. We don't want any of this kind of stuff, but we definitely want someone who reacts well to sin when confronted about it.
Mm-hmm.
We definitely want that. So that's a best case scenario. If you've got a pastor who's been caught in an affair or, with pornography or something like that, you want someone who's going to react well to that confrontation. And if they react well to that, well, does that mean they stay the pastor? Does that mean they're what, those are all questions that are going to come on an individual basis. based on what really happened and what's really going on. Mm-hmm. You know, what's best for the church and what's best for the pastor at that time is going to differ from situation to situation.
Yeah.
However, you definitely want someone who's going to react well to that. Take the example of Solomon, you know, a man who wrote the greatest wisdom literature ever written, mm-hmm. Whose Proverbs, you know, numbered in the thousands, whose poems numbered in the thousands, and songs, the Song of Solomon. Oh my gosh, the one of the most, you know, greatest celebrations of erotic love ever written.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, here's a man whose lust for women knew no bounds.
Right.
You know, he's wiser than Albert Einstein. He's richer than Bill Gates. But he's got a harem bigger than Hugh Hefner's.
Right. Right.
Right. Okay. So this is not good. Right. He's now lost all this integrity. Well, we don't look upon the wise advice he originally gave us as somehow less valuable because of what he later went through, what he later did. So if you've got that pastor who's just been, you know, such an inspiration to you, and then all of a sudden something happened, you know what? That doesn't make anything they said before any less true.
Mm-hmm.
Just because they didn't follow their own advice.
Right.
You know, how many people do we look up to? You know, people like, you know, even modern examples, people like Martin Luther King Jr., who was a powerful voice in his generation. Still, people look back to him as one of the most powerful voices of the 20th century. Mm-hmm. Still, people look back to him as one of the great liberators of our time. Still, people look back to him as an inspiration. Still, people read his letters, his writings, his speeches, and mm-hmm. repeat them over and over and over again. And yet, the guy was guilty of all kinds of affairs.
Mm-hmm.
And I understand, you know. And I'm just saying, if we can still, as a church, as individuals, we can still get inspiration from people who later turned out to be, or were discovered to be, sinners just like us.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to. So I would say, don't be disenfranchised by pastoral ministry, the church, whatever, just because. Surprise, surprise, we found out that this guy was a wicked, rotten sinner too.
Right.
Yeah. One of my favorite stories is of the reformer Martin Luther.
Mm-hmm.
He had a pastor friend who was name was Spalatin, and Spalatin was had given some advice to some of his parishioners, and the advice basically was regarding their marriage relationship, sexual relationship, and what it led to real mess. It led to like an incest situation in the church, and mm-hmm. it was a real big mess. And Spalatin was just heartbroken that he had been a part of something that had led. He'd given some bad advice that had led to these scandals that was going on in his church. It was bringing all kinds of reproach on his church. And Luther wrote him a letter, and he wrote a letter to George Spalatin, and he said, my faithful request and admonition is that you join our company and associate with us who are real, great, and hard-boiled sinners. You must by no means make Christ to seem paltry and trifling to us, as though he could only be our helper when we want to be rid of imaginary, nominal, and childish sins. No, no, that would not be good for us. He must rather be a savior and redeemer from real, great, grievous, and damnable transgressions and iniquities. Yea, from the greatest, very greatest and most shocking sins. To be brief, from all sins added together and in a grand total.
Mm, wow.
And his point is, you know, he's saying, you know, Spalatin, you used to count yourself as not one of these, you know, you were the Pharisee who had Jesus over to dinner, and then the sinful woman came and washed Jesus'
mm-hmm.
feet,
mm-hmm.
and Jesus said, she loves much because she's been forgiven much. Well, it's true. The Pharisee, in some sense, was a better person, had lived a more righteous life than that sinful woman. It's true. But because he had lived a more righteous life than that sinful woman, he believed he didn't need Jesus as much.
Right.
And so Jesus turns the tables and says, she's entering the kingdom before people like you. And and Luther does the same thing to his friend. He says, look, you need to now join the company of us great hard-boiled sinners. You need to just accept the mantle of I am capable of the kind of wicked, of all the kind of wicked things I've ever preached against.
Right.
I am capable of those things. I am, within me is a monster that without Christ would take over everything. And if you don't see yourself that way, and if we don't see pastors that way, then we will be caught off guard when those kind of things happen. I mean, we've seen it a couple times this year already in the news. There's been some scandals, and even last year too, some scandals with sexual liaisons between pastors and whoever else at different churches. Some of these, I mean, big churches, mega churches, mm-hmm. and stuff like mm-hmm. that, where we're seeing this kind of stuff happen. And of course, it brings shame upon the church. But we have to remember that the commander, Jesus Christ, is of our army. Jesus Christ, he's not thrown by this.
Sure.
It's not as if he is just, you know, losing sleep over, oh, no, now what am I going to do? I've lost my star player, you know.
Right.
He's not
right.
kicked that way. That's just not the way he's thinking. And so, therefore, we shouldn't think that way either. Is it a legitimate victory for the kingdom of darkness when pastors like that fall? Yes. Does that mean that our commander in chief is, you know, now surprised and shocked and scrambling to figure out what to do? No. He knows exactly what's going on, and he is not thrown by these things. And so we need to rest in the sovereignty of God and say, okay, that stinks. But guess what? God's grace is so much bigger. I'm looking forward to seeing how God's grace is going to be greater than this stuff.
Yeah.
We need to really kind of gear ourselves up for that and say, I expect something, God to do something good from these things, even if it's something that I can't notice or see, even if it's something that only in eternity I'll be able to look back on and say that, yes, I see how you used even that to conform us to the image of your son.
Sure,
That we have to kind of gear ourselves up for that.
I think that is really good advice, especially for those. I've met several people like this, you know, who they've lost their faith, or their faith has become severely shaken because they, you know, the pastor that raised them basically in their faith, the pastor they grew up with at their church, or maybe their youth pastor, later had an affair like while they were in youth group. You know, and you think about, for like, if you're 15 or 16 and you love your youth pastor, then he gets fired because he has an affair, and it's kind of, yeah, people do that. They throw out their entire faith because they're everything that person taught. And so I think what you said is super helpful, and I pray that those that are in that situation hear it and that God uses that. And I'll add to that too, just for myself. You know, it's funny because I can say this. I've mentioned this in, you know, sermons and such as well, but in my I've been married now for really about the exact same time. I've been in ministry about 11 years, and particularly the last 10 years I've been doing our church plant and pastoring. There's been several times I've been tempted to have an affair with someone. It wasn't like I was on it, like kissing this person or on a date with this person or anything like that. I never acted on it, but it was in my head, and it created this incredible discontent in my marriage, where I was just it created a discontent, or the discontent created, you know, the desire for this affair, this fantasy, all these sorts of things. But one thing that I'll point out that is unique to being a pastor is there is a misunderstanding of ministry that we often feel, like that people don't understand what we go through. Much like you hit on when I asked you about pornography, many of those points you made, it makes us feel like people don't understand what I go through. So, for example, the sort of proverbial, you're hanging out with your family and you get the phone call from the person in your church that needs you, and so you rush off to help that person. Now, personally, I would say don't do that, but a lot of pastors do that. And so your wife is left thinking like, man, you know, you always neglect us for your ministry. You always neglect us for your ministry. Meanwhile, you're rationalizing that, thinking, I'm doing this for God. You know, I'm this is God's the most important thing in my life. Meanwhile, you know, this is building a rift in your marriage. And then for as long as there's been, you know, ordinists in church, this sort of proverbial, like, well, the pastor had a affair with the organist has been around, or the pastor had an affair with the secretary. Or I've heard even recently, you know, a friend of mine just told me about how the church they grew up in, the pastor had an affair with the other pastor's wife. And I want to just mention that, you know, briefly in this conversation, because I think what happens is, man, we are really good at, like, rationalizing our sin and even saying, well, I could do better ministry with that person. My wife is not, like, a ministry-minded wife. And so this organist, quote-unquote, this secretary, this wife of this of my other pastor or whoever, or this just this woman in my church who's very, she loves Jesus, like, they get ministry. They would do ministry with me. And so I'm going to, you allow yourself to entertain that, and then if it's the feeling's mutual, you can end up in an affair that way without ever realizing it. And so I bring that up to pastors listening and to remind myself of this, and it goes along with what you just said. We need to never assume that it couldn't happen to us. You know, nobody ever plans on having an affair. You don't plan on that. You don't plan on getting married to your wife or your husband, if you're a woman, and saying, I'm going to have an affair someday. I think we have to do very intentional things about safeguarding ourselves, and in pastoral ministry especially. And so I would advise pastors to don't do one-on-ones with women in your church, if at all possible. There's other ways around that. You can do two-on-ones, you and another pastor and them. You can meet with them and another sort of friend of theirs. Just don't assume that it couldn't develop, because it definitely could. It definitely could. You're not above that. And those of us that say, oh, I don't need to do those things, I don't need to set those boundaries, are usually the ones that fall. They're usually the ones that fall back into it.
Absolutely. You know, there's, I love what you said there about the need to put family first in a lot of those situations, or at least put, at least think about how not to react, but rather respond in a good, really good way when it comes to when there's conflicts between family needs and ministry needs. I think that's really good. I think one of the most, one of the best little bits of, or stories, I guess it was little bits of advice, but it was a story John Piper told around the time that he was retiring from his ministry at Bethlehem Baptist Church. And he said something to the effect of, I've been blessed to be in a church that is always pushing me to spend more time with my family.
That's awesome.
And I'm blessed to be in a family that is always pushing me to spend more time doing the ministry God has called me to. And so rather than feeling the opposite, which is usually the church pulling, come be with us, come do our stuff, and the family pulling, no, you have to stay home, and you feeling the tension, instead it's this delightful push where if he's been in the office too long, they said, go home to your wife. And the wife, and if he's been lounging around at home too much, is like, you know, go help that person. They called
right.
you, go help that person, you know?
Yeah.
And when you have that kind of mutual encouragement to go be the best husband you can be, father you can be, and then the best pastor you can be, all coming from the right angles. Man, what a wonderful situation to be in. I know a lot of pastors aren't in that situation.
Mm-hmm.
And I really think it's good for churches to consider how the culture of their church and their understanding of the pastoral ministry, their understanding of what it of not just its demands or its pressures or its stresses, but just even trying to wrap their mind around what is it? You know, what exactly is it that God has called this person to do? And not just this individual, but what is pastoral ministry at all? You know, is it just that he's fulfilling certain hour requirements and allotments and certain duties
exactly.
that he has to do and certain things
right.
he has to check off his list? Or is there something at the core of this job, there's something at the core of this vocation, this calling, that we have to keep in mind so we don't miss the forest for the trees, that we don't, we you know, that we allow ourselves the flexibility to give him the time he needs to do whatever he needs to do with his family as well as with his you know, with his wife, with his kids, as well as with his ministry. You know, those are things that we have to do. And really what it comes down to is seeing pastors as people,
yes,
who need discipleship and care just like any other people do.
Right.
And, you know, so let's take one of my favorite stories, and it's a public story, so I don't feel bad telling their story like this because they've come out and talked about it for years. At Life Church, there is a pastor there, Chris Beal, and his wife Cindy. Many years ago now, his pornography addiction had kind of escalated into eventually sort of online communications with women, which eventually mm-hmm. escalated into a physical affair, mm-hmm. which eventually then turned into him conceiving a child out of wedlock mm-hmm. with his mistress. A total mess. And he had just accepted a job at this new church, at Life Church. He was a pastor there. And then he found out about this, that his mistress was pregnant. And she told him, you know, I understand your position you're in. I don't need anything from you. I just want, just letting you know this, but I don't need anything from you. Just, I can just disappear out of your life and we can just pretend like none of this ever happened and all this kind of stuff. And, he said that was sort of the tipping point where he realized he said, you know, that's when my conscience got an overload. I had been able to justify and excuse everything up to this point. But when I realized there was going to be this other child, this human being living out there in the universe who didn't know his father because his father was a coward. I couldn't do it. So he went to his church leaders. He told them what happened. He went home as soon as he was done telling them, he went home to his wife and he told her what happened. And of course, then it was you know, a total mess, right? Because now it's all kinds of stuff's coming out.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a total mess. Well, what happened really was really interesting. She writes it in her book that she writes about it in a book that she wrote about this, as well as, and he's talked publicly about this too. The kind of grace that his church showed him was just amazing. Mm-hmm. They came alongside of him. He was excused from pastoral ministry. You know, they saw the situation as, you know, it's not good for you to be in a position of leadership right now, for obvious reasons. You know, there's a real breach of integrity here. This isn't good for the church. It's not good for you. So he was excused from pastoral ministry, but they kept him as a part of the body of Christ there.
Yeah.
And he was given the utmost care and attention. He and his wife were both given the utmost care and attention, a lot of one-on-one attention from a lot of different leaders and people in the church. And this went on for months and years. Now many years later, after all this is, after the dust has settled from this and after they've seen tremendous growth in him, he actually is now a campus pastor for one of their campuses.
Wow.
And now, I understand his situation's unique, and that not a lot of people or churches can do that, and I understand that. But he, you know, he is now, you know, doing all kinds of great ministry, a great work with them, and he is a trophy of grace for the gospel. I think that's an exciting thing. I don't think that's going to be the case with every church, with every pastor, with every scandal. I don't think that at all. I don't think it's a blueprint for how everything needs to happen, so I don't want people to mishear me on that. However, I do think that the kind of environment of grace that he encountered there, he actually said that it wasn't just the conscience, you know, his conscience sort of tipping over that allowed him to make that confession, but also the fact that he had stood under the lead pastor's preaching for a while and heard the sort of the grace-saturated preaching that he was giving and knew that the people at that church were safe people to tell.
Yeah.
I think we have to have that, strive for that kind of environment where we have a church where it's okay to not be okay, even if you're the pastor. And so, of course, that leads to a lot of questions. I get that. You know, Paul does say in a couple of different places in the New Testament that elders presbyters need to be above reproach.
Sure.
So it is important that elders have integrity in their life. However, integrity does not mean sinlessness.
Yeah. And I think
Paul, at the end of his life, could say, I am the greatest of all sinners. I am the greatest of all sinners, right?
Yeah.
It is not a sinless state of being that is integrity. Integrity involves a number of different things. It involves, for one, it involves honesty about your failings.
Right,
you need to be the first one to admit to your problems. There's no corners to hide, right?
Right.
I mean, that you're telling somebody, I struggle with this. I struggle with this. So that if anyone comes out of left field and says, you are the pastor and yet you struggle with this, and then they say, well, yeah, we knew that. He's been telling us that for years.
Yeah.
We know this about him. This isn't a scandal here. That's part of what it means to be above reproach. You have no one can reproach you because you're just that honest.
Yeah.
Now, of course, does it mean a certain, track record of holiness in your life and that kind of stuff? I think it has something to do with that, of course.
Sure, sure.
But I don't think you do need to be spiritually mature to be a pastor. You should be anyway. But that said, even if you run into these scandals, affairs, pornography, whatever, you still have the opportunity there to do some ministry for that individual. That does not mean that they're never going to do ministry again or whatever. I mean, even with big scandals, I mean, I know people who have done some pretty despicable, underhanded, hypocritical things, and God did not count them out of ministry for the rest of their life.
Yeah.
Now, granted, their ministry probably doesn't look a whole lot like it looked like before. That's okay, too. You know, pastors are afraid that they're going to lose their job. Well, you know what? You might lose your job.
Right.
But that does not mean you are out of the kingdom or out of the ministry.
Right.
You are, there are, your job at your church is not the be all and end all of what it means to be in ministry. There are things that the kingdom of God has workers all over the place, doing all kinds of things. And, I understand that that's a scary thing. The pastors don't want to leave the security of that position. So they just have to ask themselves, am I okay with risking that security in order to live a life of integrity? We wrote a book, was one of the first books we published here at Covenant Eyes, called Internet Pornography, a Ministry Leader's Handbook, and it's focused on pastors who stumble into pornography, pastors who are dealing with pornography addictions and pornography temptations. That book, it's available on our website for free. You can read it. You can download it. It even has a pretty safe, benign URL, covenanteyes.com/pastorhelp. And so even if people are wondering what you're reading, if you're scared to let them know what's going on, you can look at this book, read it. It's written by pastors and counselors. It's compiled by I compiled all these chapters together, and it's a nice little book. And at the very end of the book, the advice I give pastors is, if you're dealing with a secret right now, that you don't want others to find out about because it's pornography or whatever. If you're dealing with this, then my recommendation is, I call it the Barnabas approach. It's when Paul, had been doing all kinds of evil to the church, had been imprisoning people, and rightly speaking, the apostles didn't trust him very much. So what did he do? He first went to someone who could be his ally, Barnabas. He went to Barnabas first. And because Barnabas had observed whatever he needed to observe in Paul's life, he was able to speak to Paul and talk to him. And then it says Barnabas brought him to the apostles. And that is really what you're looking for. You're looking first for a Barnabas, somebody who can be your grace ally, someone who – and I'm not grace like – I'm not talking about grace like excuse your sins and
right.
just wash, brush them under the rug. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about someone who can speak to you with mercy and tenderness and can listen to your story, to listen to what's going on, and then bring you to the people who are accountable to your integrity or should be accountable for your integrity. Do that. Start with the Barnabas and work your way out. You may end up having a lot of private conversations with your Barnabas before you actually bring it to the – quote unquote, the people that matter, people at your church that need to know whatever's going on. You may end up working through a lot of your problems with your Barnabas. You may end up, telling other people at your church, your Barnabas brings your people to the church. I've been working with this man now for a while. He's been talking to me about these things. We've been overcoming these problems. He has told me what is going on. He's told me about the changes in his life. And now I'm bringing you to him, saying that he wants to be honest with you. I think pastors will be surprised at how much grace they might receive when the right ally is there to help you make that confession. There is great power in that. I'm not saying that there's no guarantees, obviously. You still might encounter some opposition. You still might have people who want to see you hung out to dry. But let them be accountable to God for those things. You be accountable for your own integrity.
Yeah. And that's super helpful. I'm going to wrap us up here by just kind of bringing out what I think is the main point of this whole conversation. And we've said it several times. It's that pastors are real people. And that's not to say it's an excuse. We're by no means saying that. But it is something that both sides just need to really embody. I think pastors need to embody that they are real people and that they need the same accountability and support. And not just accountability, but I think the same discipleship that the people in their church need. I mean, a pastor needs to know that their identity is in Christ. So when their marriage is on the rocks, they're still whole in Christ. They don't have to look elsewhere. I mean, they need to know that same thing they're teaching their congregation. I think the church, though, especially needs to know your pastor is a real person. Treat him as such, and even realize you as a churchgoer won't be able to completely treat him like a real person because of the pastor churchgoer dynamic. So make sure, like you said earlier, Luke, make sure that your pastor has those people in their life. If it can't be you, I would say not in the denomination, but do they have those people in their life, and you can hold them accountable to having those people in their life that can do that. I think, too, this isn't something we have time to get into, but I'll just say briefly for anyone listening, I think seminaries and Bible colleges need to address this much better. I'll just throw that out there as a quick shout out, so to speak. I think it's something that needs to be a part of the curriculum, needs to be talked about a lot, like a lot. So give Luke, let you throw in any closing thoughts you have, and let listeners know on my website. I'll post this episode, and it's at acrossroads.net, and I'll link to the Internet Pornography and Ministry Handbook you mentioned, and the covenize.com/pastorhelp link you mentioned. I'll also link to Luke, your personal ebooks, as well as the Covenant Eyes ebooks. Luke, can you tell us too, real quick, what's the name of that Life Church book you were talking about that the guy's wife wrote?
Well, the author is Cindy Beal.
Okay, Cindy Beal.
Let me quickly look at the.
Is it B-E-A-L?
Look at my bookshelf here and see B-E-A-L-L.
L-L, okay.
And the book is called Healing Your Marriage When Trust is Broken. So it's written primarily for wives.
That sounds like a great resource, yeah.
It is a really good one.
Yeah.
We should probably mention, because I hate to leave off on this point, please don't neglect pastors' families when these kind of things happen.
Sure.
It's awful. It really is awful. We talk to wives here, pastors' wives, who actually know about their husband's secret problems, but cannot or feel they cannot tell anybody because they, now he might lose his job, and then what will happen to us and all this kind of stuff. Women like that are in terrible situations, absolutely terrible situations, where they feel like they can't get help for themselves, for their husband. They can't do anything because their husband has basically told them, don't tell anybody about this. Do not say anything about this. First of all, I would say to the husband who's putting that kind of the pastor husband who's putting that kind of a chokehold on your wife is you've just really got to cut that crap out.
Yeah.
That is not only are you looking at porn and really kind of hurting your wife's feelings in the process, which is, you know, bad enough, but then you're basically saying, don't tell anybody about this. I know you have, I know you feel bad about this, but you just, you know, you can't say anything. You can't get help and you can't, you know, whatever. We've actually told wives at certain points, it would be a grace from God if you outed your husband.
That's abuse, man. That's abuse. That's like the same as physical abusers that are like, don't tell anyone this or I'll kill you. You know, it's like,
it's really shady stuff. You really have to, and we know I lose count the number of pastors' wives I know that our team here has spoken to about this. It's heartbreaking to hear that kind of stuff. And then the same thing with the woman who just finds out about her husband's problem because of whatever, you know, she discovers it or he's confessed it to the whatever. That also, she has to, no matter what the situation the wife is in, she has to be given the same amount of care and mercy and discipleship and counsel that the husband's receiving.
Right.
To receive, I mean, it's not the same kind of counsel or the same, you know, style of counsel necessarily, but she has been harmed by another's sins, and she cannot be just sort of forgotten about. She is a casualty in the war, and she has to be dealt with that way. She has to be nurtured and cared for that way. So please do not neglect the pastor's wife in this. This is that's one of those big overlooked areas. Or the pastor's children, I might add.
Yeah.
When dad's a porn addict and dad's a pastor and the kids are, I mean, talk about a family nightmare. I mean, it really is a mess. So we just have to try to be very, very cautious of how we minister to those people and don't leave them out. If people are interested, and I would say to this to any pastor or ministry leader who's listening right now, if people are interested in getting any of this stuff, not just the stuff that's specific to pastors, but go to covenanteyes.com/ebooks, you'll get a list of all of our, you know, more than a dozen or so free ebooks you can download. We've got books on porn addiction. We've got books for wives. We've got books for parents. We've got books for families. All that stuff is there. It's available for you to download for free. You, as a pastor, you don't need a specific book for pastors, although that would be helpful.
Sure.
You are a human being first, so therefore treat yourself like one and read a book about porn addiction like you would, like any other human being might read one if they're struggling with this. Read it and devour it and try to get a handle on these things in your life. Seek out good accountability. Find the safe person to go to. Find your Barnabas. Begin walking through these things. In fact, I would walk through these books with a Barnabas is what I would do.
Yeah,
I would just sit down, find a great resource on this, sit down with your Barnabas and say, I'm going to meet with you every week, and I'm going to talk to you about what I'm learning in this book, and you're going to read this book along with me, and I need help on this. Do this. You need to. If you don't do this, you will probably receive a whole lot more understanding if you are a person who outs himself, confesses these problems, deals with it like a man, and stands up and says, I've taken responsibility for these actions, and I'm going to take responsibility for doing what I need to do to go to the throne of grace and find the help I need. Mm-hmm. If you're that kind of man, you're going to probably receive a whole lot more understanding from the outside world, from your church, from your other leadership in your church. Yeah, if you work for a really hypocritical church where there's a bunch of people in there who just want to throw stones at you,
sure.
You know, maybe it's a grace from God that you are fired.
Just
get out of there. But let them wander their 40 years in the wilderness till they die out. And I say that with the utmost grace that I can. But seriously, if that's your situation, maybe you need to get out. Still, nonetheless, take responsibility for these things, and you may be surprised at the level of understanding and grace you receive from the body of Christ.
Amen.
At least that would be my prayer.
Yeah, absolutely, man. Well, Luke, this has been excellent, and I would encourage, those listening that if they are in this struggle, to please get a hold of Covenant Eyes, write in, figure out what resources are there for you. I would even say I make myself available. There's a contact form on my blog. Feel free to write in to me, and I'm definitely willing to help you find those first steps, help you brainstorm some people that are safe in your life that you can talk to about these things, because Satan wants us to think we're the only one that struggles with it, and we're not. And Satan wants us to think that if we told anyone, it would be the worst thing in the world, when really it would be the best thing in the world. So,
yeah.
Luke, this is fantastic, man. We're gonna leave it here, and just thank you for all the work you're doing at Covenant Eyes. I'm really excited to continue just referring people to you guys. You're doing a great work, and man, just thanks. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Noah. It's been great to talk to you, and again, I actually just want to thank anyone for listening, because if you, chances are, if you found this and you clicked on it and you listened to the whole thing, it's because you really need some of this information in your life. And I don't know if that's because you're the pastor or the wife or the ministry leader or the co-ministry leader or whatever your situation is, but if you're still listening at the end of this podcast after all this time of talking, you are... I just want to thank you for listening.
Yeah.
You need, I encourage you to continue finding the help you need.
Yes.
Because God's grace is bigger than any sin we can muster up. So.
1, 2, 3. As I mentioned in the conversation with Luke, I would encourage you to re-listen to parts of that conversation. Take notes, take bullet points on it. Show it to your church elder board or leadership team. Show it to your team of pastors. I'd encourage you to pass it along to your pastor or pastors. And as I said in the intro, if you're interested in adding Covenant Eyes to your computer or those that you know, you can use the promo code CROSSROADS, and that promo code will give you 2 free months of Covenant Eyes to check. With that CROSSROADS promo code, I should point out that the 2 months free, that deal expires about a week from today. On August 22nd, the 2 months free will no longer be valid. Posting today's podcast on August 14th, so you have about a week to use that. If you're listening after August 22nd, the CROSSROADS promo code is still good to give you 1 free month. Of Covenant Eyes to check out. So just want to make sure I clarify that. So with that, we will wrap up episode 9 of the Behind the Curtain Ministry podcast. Thanks for tuning in. Check us out on iTunes and subscribe so you will be notified the next time we post an episode. Until then, I will see you behind the curtain and at a crossroads. Thank you.